Well, I read Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man.
That's a big book. That's a big book, Katie. You read that over 2 days?
Well, I can't say that I read every word, but I've at least skimmed every section. And I picked out the sections that I liked.
Okay.
That I was most interested in. Because, you know, it goes through media by media by media and talks about each different thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I wish that I would have read this before Gutenberg Galaxy. I don't know. I know it was written after.
Yeah.
But I thought this was easier. Now, maybe it's because the material is easier for me now. I don't know. But,
it's written easier. It's easier. It's poppy. It's about the present. Gutenberg Galaxy is a lot of historical scholarship. Yeah, definitely Gutenberg's harder.
Yeah. And so the first thing that I'm thinking about today, because it's the anniversary of that shooting last year at Sandy Hook, is the whole argument about gun control is that guns don't kill people. People kill people using guns.
Yeah.
But if the medium is the message, then, I mean, that changes that whole conversation that I hear people having today.
Yes. What did you say about Sandy Hook and Ed being killed? What's that?
No, a kid. Kids being killed. Children were killed at Sandy Hook.
How were they killed?
You know, a shooter went in and just started killing a bunch of kids. It was last year. But now it's the anniversary of it. So, of course, the whole gun control conversation is all over the place today on TV and whatnot.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so
yes,
I'm kind of thinking
control.
About that. Yeah. And I don't necessarily want to talk about that, but it's just interesting when you understand media from a McLuhan perspective. It really does change the way you look at all of that stuff.
Okay. I'll give you a McLuhan insight on this. Gun control is a big issue in the United States. Doesn't seem to be a big issue in other countries. It's particular to the United States, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And somewhat Canada has a smugness about which I know you're... Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
We got that European patina in there. But anyways, you take the United States as a type, a character, a feature, a meme, and it was the only country ever built on the printing press. And it's the only country where you go to be alone. It's in a country that really exaggerates the I and always has a frontier mentality because new technologies upset the previous stability, the previous sense of community. You get all this anarchy going on. With a visually biased person, you can see that more important than the penis is the gun and the rifle for preserving the American identity. It's all an eyeball issue. You aim the gun, you aim for your target. Now, when you get into a tactile electric digital environment where nobody can even figure out what the targets are anymore, this puts the old visually biased and kinetic biased American into a panic state, and he'll focus the rest of his next 20 decades preserving his right to hold a gun because he's gone back to his fundamentalist technical meme. Now, that was just an example of how you apply McLuhan to an issue. Isn't that neat?
It's very neat, and I also noticed that it's becoming really popular for women to have and want guns and to shoot guns.
That's
so I don't know if that was
distinctions. No, with several bodies, the chemical body becomes a blur. This is why we have the acceptance of gay stuff, lesbian stuff, all this stuff that would be outrageous 20, 30 years ago. Chemical body's a blur. Nobody cares about the chemical body other than some people are very protective of it and paranoid. So you cannot put the sexual distinction on protecting the chemical body if you're an American. The American is preserving the gun. The right to carry the eyeball is really what's going on, to have an eyeball. And so both men and women can join in that equally and prop it up by, you know, taking gun lessons and watching TV and having a cell phone and shooting people every 3 minutes. That's what goes on in all the TV shows, right?
So it doesn't have anything to do with penis envy on a woman's...
No. Now it's eyeball envy. It's eyeball
envy.
That's a good point. We are preserving, or Americans are preserving, and I don't have this myself, having grown up in France and then in Canada many years, but... we are preserving the right to look and stare and aim and have a goal and carve out our own individualist space. And that is all hooked up by the gun or the pistol or the rifle. So we feel threatened by every other psychological and cultural meme that's floating there in the global theater that comes at us every day from all the different cultures. So we're going to be fanatic. That's their fundamentalism. People are more fundamental about the eyeball than about the Bible or about whatever you think fundamentalism is in the religious culture. The bigger thing is the chemical body, American version, foot. Foot is kinetic. Let me keep traveling the trails, the lonely trails out west. That's the visual space of the American. And that's what the president's in there for, to defend that meme. And of course, nobody lives like that anymore. Nobody lives in the chemical body. And there's a huge hypocrisy or lack of definition about these issues because they're familiar. You can talk about our memes, about our saving kids from being shot, and not deal with the media swill that's upsetting everybody's body. That's the ethical part of it.
Okay, well, then these shootings that have taken place by these people who are often diagnosed with some sort of mental illness, and then, of course, there's the whole conversation about them being often a Manchurian candidate and that there's some sort of, like, conspiracy
program
thing going on. Yeah. So what's that?
Well, that's
Because we live in because everybody has so much anxiety now because our nervous system is exposed?
Yeah, the lone nut scenario. You know, the idea that there's an individual out there, a lone nut, who kills presidents and neighbors and all that, that's the ultimate wilderness frontier image of the American. He's out there all by himself, and he's sniping away at whoever bothers him, and they always take what kind of...
Carol on drugs.
Oh, Carol adds the chemical programming. Yes, the chemical body is well programmed on the chemical drug level. But you have this archetype, whether they're on drugs or MKUltra or not, is the individual taking matters into his own hands and defending his right to have an eyeball and to create space from the eyeball. That's what the gun is. And so whether they're programmed, or what was the other issue, why are they mentally insane? Do you blame the hospitals for releasing people? No, those are particular local memes. It's all paranoia of the chemical body, and that's what we don't want to recognize, how paranoid we've made our chemical bodies. Where did gated communities come from, you know, 30 years ago? That's social paranoia caused by television. When your parents bought your TV in the 50s or 60s, you did not know, and your parents didn't know, that it would lead to this state of American society. Because a tactile TV will threaten a kinetic, visually biased culture. So you did it. Your parents did it with television. And it wasn't based on their religion or their education or their work profession or their class. They all bought TV because it was a new novelty. And then that got hyped up in the digital phase even to more extreme. So I will stop, and you say something.
Well, the next thing that I wanted to say that I loved was the media of light and how that's the only media that doesn't need any content.
Yeah.
The light, and then that just got me thinking about Ion talking about us being salt and light, and I wonder if that's at all related or if I'm just making something up that's not really got any kind of a correlation to
it. No, that's very important. Very important.
Okay, and it just seems that since light was the creation story of light, was that light was spoken into being, and again, it's the only, because one thing that I liked about this book too is it really talked about how different media affects each other and can change its temperature, and like for example, that the wheel was a precursor to movies. I mean, I would never thought about that ever, and that wheels are used to project film, and that the movie projector or movies were originally created to try to see who could win an argument about whether a horse ever had all four of its hoofs off the ground at once when it was running. Like, all that kind of stuff in this book was so fascinating to me because it wasn't just so much about books, and I've got to tell you an embarrassing thing that I discovered about myself is that it's just so crazy to me that I wanted to talk about books in the beginning because I'm a writer, and I was just so afraid that they were going to become obsolete before I ever got my novels published.
Mm-hmm.
And so now to look at all this other stuff, it just made it even like way more interesting and also way more overwhelming. But yeah, if you could speak to that light thing, I'd be interested in what you have to say about that.
Okay, there's... for the more sophisticated connoisseur of McLuhan, once you read a lot of them and you get to see what he repeats, you get familiar with it, you understand the ideas, you then start to realize he's satirizing the medium as the message. And then you realize there's Kabbalistic metaphors and symbols in there. And then you find out from Ion he's a parallel worlder. Then you find there's a whole bunch of metaphor symbolism in his writing. So that's for later appreciation, once you get used to the basic ideas, but the basic ideas are counterintuitive and takes a while to get them, and you're enjoying that. The light bulb...
But he knew exactly what he was doing when he was doing this?
Oh, yeah, it was all faked. I reread Mechanical Bride, which was based on a slideshow, whatever slideshows they had in the 40s, that he would give whatever photography projection slide things he would have back then. He would play ads and comic books in his classroom, or even do public lectures. Nobody had ever looked at ads or comic books. And so he organized that slideshow into a book called The Mechanical Bride. It came out in 1951. It took 6 years for it to be accepted by Vanguard editors in New York. They kept, pruning it, and they were shocked by it. The advertising community, whoever was management of that on the secret business level, just told the company, book press, not to publish it. It was against the law. They tried to make a case against it. They were so humiliated. Someone was actually scrutinizing ads. It was a given environment. Nobody took us to, and not allowed to look at it. And yet McLuhan could do it because he didn't have any copyright problems. You can just post any ads or scenes from comic books if you wanted to. So he beat them, but they really tried to stop him. So it was quite shocking what he did. But I reread that book lately, and I find many of the ideas in understanding media are in Mechanical Bride. He really had his vision about what's happening by the late 40s, early 50s. And but then when any new technology came along, like Sputnik in 57, he'd be ready to adjust his approach to the new style that the medium would create. So he later would say that Mechanical Bride was an obsolete book because it analyzed society just on the end of the movie radio phase and TV coming in. And he said TV changed the Mechanical Bride, which on one level is woman, into the expendable jujube, in the jujube being candy in the 60s. So he redid the Mechanical Bride in 1970 called Culture's Our Business, and it's a tremendous book too. But the you can look at, he figured out media ecology in the late 40s, early 50s, with great help from James Joyce and Wyndham Lewis. And so I sent out, I think I posted on Dupes, my notes that I took from reading the book over the last few weeks, and just pointing out all the amazing phrases and concepts. So yes, Manipian satire, he said, when I did his archives, I found a little note, and he said, understanding media is treating speech as archetypal. He took speech as a medium. Speech is the verbal content of understanding media, and also Gutenberg Galaxy. And he said, he's not advocating what he's saying. He's noticing by the mid-50s that a lot of intellectuals are beginning to notice that technology is having profound effects beyond ethical, political, ideological, and previous 19th century opinionated concerns. It was just becoming a juggernaut. And so as people started to notice what he called elephantiasis, or the expansion, huge new figure of the communication media, they didn't even know the word media at that point. He coined the word media. But they're talking about technology machines taking over. And you had science fiction people by 1950 writing about this. Well, he took that meme, that new idea that would happen for the next 50 years of people being swamped as they woke up to all kinds of machines and technologies taking them over. He took that idea and he said, I'm going to satirize it. And the main thing they're all going to realize is the medium is the message. But I particularly don't necessarily believe the medium is the message, but I'm going to write a book about with that theme and say that the book is screaming this. The book is pleading for turn off television, turn off radio. Let's go back to the Gutenberg Galaxy for a little bit and retrieve the values of the book. So you have to remember, there's no McLuhan in his books. No McLuhan. He's taking English language, which is obsolete, and the verbal speech mechanism, and having it speak. Now, this was proven later when he tried to get some people interested in making a Broadway musical, where it would only be various media environments, television, movies, TV, cars, and automobiles and manuscripts, they would be the characters. The characters would do this speaking in the Broadway musical. There'd be no people. So he recognized that the chemical body was really losing its ground by the 50s. So that's all an answer. I can go on for hours in great detail.
Well, I want you to tell me.
But this, I'm responding to you saying, did he know ahead of time? Yes. He did what Gurdjieff called, well, Ouspensky took it from Gurdjieff. He did objective art, like the pyramid. The art is based on knowing the effects it'll have on people. He knew all the effects and how people would read it. Not subjective art. We make a nice painting or a musical piece and you hope people like it. This was covering the whole range of human interpretation of what a medium was. So that's my answer to yes, he had it planned ahead of time.
Well, is he like, I mean, I don't know how to ask this question without sounding really dumb, so I'll just risk it.
No, look, no media is dumb. So you can say anything. It's not dumb because we need any content to spark any direction. McLuhan said he wrote Understanding Media by just grabbing whatever is around nearby. It's the only way to write a book in response to the global theater of media overkill. It is to start grabbing out. So everything's useful. So you're useful, so there's no dumbness.
Okay.
There could be inappropriately a way of saying it or an inadequate way, and I'll correct that if I can. But no notion is obsolete.
Well, what I specifically mean is, did he come into our world at a particular time in our planetary history to talk about this stuff so that when we got to this point where we're all freaked out because our nervous system has been extended, that we would know what was going on and then you could learn all about it and invoke Ion? I mean, was this, that's really what I'm asking.
Yes, yes. No, McLuhan would, you know, say he stood on the shoulders of a lot of important avant-garde, little-known writers. Mainly, they were Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce doing Finnegan's Wake, but also Ezra Pound.
Who's that Mumford person, too? He talks
Lewis
about Mumford
was an academic intellectual in the 30s and 40s, and he was one of the early intellectuals who started to notice that the medium was the message. He didn't use those words, but he started to notice in history that technology was shaping society. The idea that technology shapes a particular culture was sort of lurking around with various intellectuals because you couldn't help notice it if you were a thinker back, you know, 80 years ago. But McLuhan took that new idea and made fun of it or pushed it, turned it into a poetry, turned it into a science. He played with Mumford. And so Mumford hated McLuhan. And McLuhan used to make fun of Mumford. But people go back and read Mumford. They say, well, this guy wrote Understanding Media before McLuhan did. They don't understand why two guys who were pretty well saying the same thing did not like each other. That's because Mumford was still involved in his mind and trying to find a reason why, and he discovered this new level of media ecology, what media environments are doing, and he didn't know McLuhan was not in the content of McLuhan's books. He was satirizing people finding out that the medium was the message. Now, that's pretty neat.
Oh,
very avant-garde art. This is way beyond anybody, Marcel Duchamp or Robert Anton Wilson, whatever the church subgenius or your local Charlie Rose promotes. Nothing compares to McLuhan. He was the Leonardo da Vinci of our world, you know, in terms of
that, I mean, that's what I'm asking you. I mean, that's a good answer. He was the Leonardo da Vinci of our world.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so floored not only by all of the observations about the various media, but his grasp of history. Like, you would have to know, I didn't know, for instance, that a fully armored knight needed a stirrup to mount a horse.
Right,
because
right.
He couldn't get on the horse. You know, that, like, how did he know that?
What you do is you read a lot. Now, McLuhan, when he was 19 years old, in his diary, he wrote, now this would be his first year student at the University of Manitoba, whichever college, university was out there in Winnipeg. I think it was that one, but there's others, I understand. So he was at college out there, and he writes in his diary, he was born in 1911, so it's like 1929, 1930. He says, I know I will discover laws, new laws that man has never seen. You know, like a genius, he kind of knew his destiny, just like me saying all that stuff on CKLN 30 years ago and miming Ion to be. It's a product of the time, and you're an artist or scientist, you've got perfect pitch. Well, he had as a kid, and he's saying, I will discover the laws. So that's 1930, so he produces the book Laws of Media in the late 70s. It didn't get published. He passed on, but it got published in 1988. So 50 years, 60 years later, his laws came out as a book form. Now, he was developing his laws in The Mechanical Bride. He uses that term in the late 40s and 50s. So he knew that we'd come to a point in technology that it didn't matter what new gadgets were invented, what new amazing hardware was invented. We were in the age of what he called software pattern recognition. And people would, in a simple term, we extended our mind to an environment outside of us, and people will spend most of the 20th century, you know, flopping around trying to get a perspective using their mind. And so he was on top of that and didn't use his mind. He was the first to get to go and just look at the environment and let the environment speak, rather than, like most people do, figure out what they think, what their opinion is, what their neighbors think, and what new stuff. Now, so he started figuring, started intuiting something in 1930. All through the 30s at the University of Manitoba, and then he goes to Cambridge, he reads an incredible amount of stuff. He, you know, people, his son and people who knew him said, Marshall, you know, by the 50s had read everything. And his PhD is extraordinary in its own history of 1,500 years of reading. So he, you know, he lost a lot of his vision. I think he had very bad vision by the time I met him in the 50s. But so he read everything. So then because he knew that the medium was the message, not the content, he could, he would, his office was right beside the Catholic Library on the University of Toronto campus. So every night his assistant or he himself would go over and get eight books and carry home eight books from the library, walk or drive home, and he'd be able to skim them because he had a framework or context. He wasn't trying to figure out what to learn, what to know, what to repeat, to find an idea that he could hoik up as a flag. No, he could skim. He even took speed reading courses. He could skim stuff to find samples, to find quotes to fit into his system. And so Lynn White wrote a book on the stirrup in the medieval
period. Yeah, I'm just going to mention her next.
Yeah, no, it's a male. Lynn is a man.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, the late Lynn White. So he writes this book in the early 60s or something. McLuhan, because he's up on The New Yorker and magazines and newspapers, he's just scanning information to see how to fit into his art. He sees that book immediately, gets it out of the library, scans through, finds a relevant point, and gets it. You know what I mean? And if you look at the back of Understanding Media, you got a lot of books listed there. And many people thought they had to read all those books to understand them. And he says, no, no, you don't have to read those books. It's not meant for there. Read, just pick a couple of them. They're meant to be guides. But it showed his variety of source, his encyclopedism. That's why there's so many books in the bibliography. But he didn't expect you to read them. Just read one of them. Just read Lynn White will blow your mind. Just read
Umbridge
on Art. What?
My mind is so blown, it's not even funny.
Now, let's look at that blown. What that means is your normal habit of pattern recognition has a whole bunch of new data that might require you to shift what your focus is in your mind's anchor. You know what I mean? You might become a lesbian. You might become a Catholic. You might give up writing. You might have another baby. That would be an identity crisis. McLuhan was such a powerful writer, like a new technology, he would create, challenge your self-image. That's what blown mind is. Your self-image becomes weak, and you either struggle to get an old self-image, or you struggle to violently to get a new image. Usually it requires a lot of antisocial behavior to forge a new image. Just look at teenagers every day. They're trying to, the normal process of being a teenager is already a question of what's my identity. And they got four bodies to juggle. It's just impossible for a young person to not be violent. You see what I'm saying? Or to take drugs and all that stuff they do. Because they're in a total identity crisis, long range. So when you have a blown mind, you've just lost your image. Now you're going to look around for new images. And hopefully these conversations give you retrieve a stronger image, or you go to the ionic level and go for the eternal image, or because we're talking about social language here. And when you pointed out that media affect media, that's right. Technologies are social mortar. They actually don't affect you, the God, at all, but they affect your social life, which is held together by social languages. And so he documented the history of social media affecting other languages and other technologies all through the you know, 10,000 years, because it could be done in the 20th century. So McLuhan is the poet of the second half of the 20th century. You say James Joyce is the first half. And remember, all of his work is translating Finnegans Wake, translating in a new way. So like all the great artists and poets in history, they all were great translators. They did their homework. They did their scholarship. And then they developed their own vision. So McLuhan was a perfect expression of how one could, if they had the right advantages or background or genius or whatever, see the world as he saw it. So the 20th century was so new, it required a new vision, and he did it. And that's why Ion showed their extreme understanding of McLuhan when, 3 months ago in one of those many private sessions I played, Ion says, well, what about Marshall McLuhan's autobiography? And I said, he didn't write any autobiography. And he says, oh, yes, he did. So we had this little back and forth. And I said, well, what do you mean? Let's go through the books. Gutenberg Galaxy? No. Understanding Media? No. Even though we used to say understanding media, break down the word media, media. McLuhan's explaining what literate man would die in the 20th century. So understanding media, is that autobiographical? No. Then I suddenly remembered, From Cliché to Archetype, came out in 1970. He goes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I said, you are right, Ion. Yes, us few knowledgeable McLuhan people. I mean, I'm probably brought up first, and Ion could have just got it for me. There's another part. He just zapped it in my mind. Not many people have noticed that From Cliché to Archetype is about himself, about when he was famous, and then he became well-known. Everybody got bored of him. They dropped him. That's a cliche. And then he becomes, a little later, they figure out, they realize he's correct, so then he becomes an archetype. He's been in the archetype phase for, 20 years now. So he knew this, From Cliche to Archetype. And it's, he said, a more important book than Understanding Media. And it's a replay.
Well, I have that from the library still, but it was too hard for me 3 weeks ago. Maybe it's not too hard for me now.
That's right. It's all too hard. I mean, you're having a great shift of perception. And just plug along. You're not going to get it all. And just sort of just see what you notice as you read each page.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Ion with a very knowing statement that Cliché Archetype is McLuhan's autobiography. And that is right. And so you got to give it to Ion. Either he's got incredible ESP. He can vacuum your mind and find out that little fact in my mind when a few people had it and know it's relevant and say it back to me. See, that's how. So we're appreciating Ion here as well as McLuhan. But you can see why Ion picked McLuhan as the best thinker, human chemical body thinker, to mime at least or anticipate the huge environmental effect of Ion.
He had to know because none of this stuff. I know the TV is the big thing, but I still can't get over Web 2.0. I would love for you to speak about that too. How that's different than TV, or is that just TV in a smaller?
Now here's where McLuhan say people always live, a decade or a generation behind. Understanding Media is such an old crotchety book. It actually got obsolete because there's not one medium that's in there, radio, movies, TV, that a young person has experienced in the last 20 years.
Right.
They don't experience a telephone as a separate thing, or a movie, or a TV. So none of the media, in Understanding Media, would communicate to kids. Now, Frank Zangroni, which was a good student of McLuhan's, a professor at York University in Toronto, told me in the 90s that he could not teach Understanding Media anymore, and he was a great McLuhanite. He did a book, he did The Essential McLuhan. Now you'll see Frank Zangroni and Eric McLuhan. You were looking up that book for the Da Vinci to Holmes thing the other night. Frank Zangroni's name's on there. He said, because the kids by the 90s were growing up with these mixed media, digital complex things, and TV was on their iPhones or whatever they had back then. In other words, you had to rewrite. You had to rewrite Understanding Media in a new way because you couldn't use TV, radio, and movies. Now, note, your mind, you don't live in the past. Your behavior, you live in the present, Web 2.0. But your mind is 100 years back there. You never even considered these ancient dinosaur media when they were new in environments themselves. So it's all new for you to read Understanding Media. But to get to the today, where we're rampant, the Android meme replays everything that was ever done, including McLuhan. That's where my stuff comes in. I updated McLuhan and then got into the five bodies. You wouldn't use McLuhan at all, but I know people are so far back there. And that's why Marshall, Ion told Sasha, after she got a lot of the rewrites, she says, what's next? And he said, Bob, because you got to go back and read the social mortar assumptions in your head that are making up an identity that is not the way you actually live today. You don't live a TV-shaped personality or a telephone-shaped personality. You live with five bodies today. but you'd have to hear me to tell you that. But
I enjoyed it so much, though. I loved reading about it. It evoked such nostalgia in me.
Right, because it's archetypal. Cliched archetype.
Loved it.
Not only refers to him, but it also refers to the book itself, his work. It's a great poem, just like, you know, Dante's comedy, any of the great Shakespeare. The great literature, everybody enjoys. The great art, because it has a certain eternal point within its century, within its era. And it communicates mm-hmm. something with the era, has perfect pitch. So it's a great, it's like reading Gulliver's Travels. That's what Understanding Media is. The great mm-hmm. work. And yeah,
okay,
you will enjoy it.
Oh, loved it. Will you talk more about light? My specific question was, talk to me about light,
yeah,
the media,
okay.
and how does that differ from the light that I am?
All right. So, well, the light you are, okay, is you are made up of ions, says salt, and light. That's what we're all made up of if you're using matter, whatever they are, frequency, salt, and light. But I discussed it with Carolyn. I think I checked this with Ion a while ago, but I don't recall. I can't play it. But then I added protein, sugars, and fats. Basically, we're made up of salt and light, protein, sugars, and fats. And then below that is the cellular. Well, I found a big discovery session, what was that? A session in June or July 2010, where Ion's talking to Carolyn. And this never was heard before, as far as I know, as he took the three kingdoms, the outer kingdom, the inner kingdom, and the middle kingdom, and he matched it to our biology, which is very useful, because these three categories are just abstract notions that Ion's saying. We don't have anything to hook it into what we know in our multi-bodied world, but here it is. The outer kingdom is the respiratory system, basically breathing, oxygen. The inner kingdom, can you say whether the inner kingdom is cellular or vascular? What would you say?
What would
I
say?
Do you know what vascular means?
Yeah, that would be blood.
Right. Is that the inner kingdom, or is the cellular part of our cells the inner kingdom?
I don't know.
Well,
I'm tempted to guess vascular because of the vampire popularity right now, and maybe there's something going on with that, but I don't know.
Now, look at the way your mind worked there. You adapt a TV landscape, a TV body image. Like, you know, is that kind of medieval? It could be caveman talk, because we're talking about biology, and all of a sudden you quote a TV show. But this is the way we live
right.
today. 50 years
right.
ago, someone wouldn't think that way. They wouldn't quote a TV show.
Right.
To help do some scientific definition. So right there, you can look at how your mind works and how it's conditioned by
mm-hmm.
the present. Now it's different from the past. So, yes, you're right to pick the vascular, because it's blood, and the heart of the matter is a matter of the heart. The whole inner kingdom is the emotions, you know, contained by the force field of love. So definitely the vascular is the inner kingdom, and the cellular is the middle kingdom. And this is beautiful. The middle kingdom is your now, always becoming nowness, now, now, now. The cells are adjustable. And so they're always adapting between the relationship between the oxygen, the outer kingdom, and the blood, the inner kingdom, and it's registered in the middle kingdom, in the cellular. And, of course, our products affect the cellular, which then have amazing
right.
effects on our oxygen, amazing effects on our blood. So what we have here, I wanted to bring this up at some point. If Ginny had come on, I would have said it to her at the beginning, but she was busy, so... We now can relate. When someone asks you what the outer kingdom is, say your respiratory system. This is now what we're doing is we're giving biological imagery for three abstract notions, and Ion says the three kingdoms of them are the best way to analyze the body. You don't want to know all the details that scientists have developed within the particular organs or in the cellular or all the diseases. If you just know the three kingdoms and can match them onto your oxygen, blood, and your cells, that's what our products deal with. That's all you need to know. And
mm-hmm.
as you get more ascendant, your oxygen decreases. So it changes. So you end up just have changed blood, which you don't want the local hospital to know about, because they'll start imprisoning you or isolating you as a freak. But those are the three important parts of yourself, your oxygen, blood, and your cells, and they match with the three kingdoms. So Ion shows that the three kingdoms are a model, a paradigm that applies to thousands of years in any different kind of culture and its peculiar way of coming up with his body image. The three kingdoms cover it all, and including the 20th century understanding of the body. So now, light is part of this structure, And light is not just visual. Light is your movement of your blood and your oxygen and your cells. They try to visualize it on drugs, you know, psychedelic imagery, or the microscopes, electron microscopes will show this and that. A lot of extravagant imagery for showing the central nervous system. Now, when the telegraph came along, they extended the central nervous system. That was the extension of electricity. Electricity is tactile. It's not any one particular sense. So the light bulb is an electric technology, one of the first. And it is the electric environment made visible. But it is more than book visible. It's not flat visual space. It's tactile, proprioceptive space. And what's unique, because it's a transition from the print world, where because speech was the content of books, everybody thought media had content when they were going through the Gutenberg phase for 300 or 400 years. But when you went into a totally new biological environment, that's Teilhard de Chardin's term for electricity, it's a new biological event, you're into a whole new water, you're new fish swimming in a new environment, the expression of that is in the transition from a book to then telegraph pure electricity into electric media like radio, movies, and television, which have content. The transitional electric tactile medium is the light bulb. It doesn't have any content. It's pure electricity, and shows how electricity is a decentralized environment that illuminates whatever is around it. It's pervasive. So the light bulb... go ahead.
I was just going to say, it creates... like it creates a space, right?
That's right. It visualizes the electric effect. Telegraph creates a new space, a biological structure, the beginning of the TV landscape and then later your TV body. People couldn't see that. People never noticed when they were going out west in the 19th century, they never noticed the telegraph poles. Never talked about them. And yet that was really was turning, they were all going out west. They visualized, okay, there's a whole new span, so I'm an American, I can go out there, get my own property, kill a few Indians, survive, whatever, all that mythology. And so they went somewhere visually and kinetically organized. And they went somewhere, and they didn't know that they were going to be everywhere instantly once the telegraph shows up. So pretty soon they got a telegraph office, Western Union, there out in the little frontier towns, and you're in touch with the whole planet. And that has swallowed up your visual bias that you've got to go 1,000 miles to get to Colorado or something, you know, from Minnesota. So the electric environment is pervasive. It's beyond space and time. It has no visual dimensions. But the closest visuality of it is the light bulb. And the light bulb is odd. It doesn't have any content. It just illuminates. It creates an environment. And that's what electricity does. So, yes, the
sense. So, do I create an environment? Do I, as light, create an environment?
Yes, but when before people were literate, their eyeballs were broadcasters. And you can get tribal people, pre-literate people, all see the evil eye. The eye is active. But once you start reading passively 300 or 400 years ago, you developed a passive eyeball that received imagery. God blessed you. You weren't a god and made spaces. That's pre-literate. But under the novelty of literacy, it's, oh, I don't make spaces, I receive space. And so God looks upon me. So the passive eye then was contradicted by the new making eye of the electric age. And so the light bulb is not just the passive eyeball. It's making space like you do. Now your divine light, your divine salt, light, protein, sugar, fats, or three kingdoms, is a making process constantly. And depending on what culture and technological environment and its habits have conditioned you, you'll have different concepts about the making part of your divine self. Or let's call it your devilish self. Let's not get too religious. Your crappy, stupid, eternal self that's living here forever and you can't stand it. Okay? So the technologies that come and express the original power of your being gets really strong when the electric age. That's when you can swallow whole planets and communicate information to everybody. A lot different than writing a letter to one person or sending a book to one person. So the power of the electric environment, and then it gets digitized, and then you become a junkie. You start taking the electric environment once it's digitized, and you can immediately put on the whole universe like you do when you take heroin. That's why the LSD only was a passing fad. You see movies with LSD, but you don't put on the whole universe. You might put on it, you get some sensation, but you get a lot of visual, multisensory engagement, which is fun, which is just the signaling system being scrambled, according to the Evergreens, played during Bobfest. But heroin, immediately within a few minutes or seconds, puts you bigger than the universe. You go right into bliss. Mm-hmm. It's like going to the guff, right? And and you don't have visual content. You don't have sensory engagement. You're just a zombie. You've just become supreme for the chemical body. So the electric environment, more and more when it went digital, had turned everybody into putting on the whole universe like junk. So Web 2.0 made everybody either not have to take drugs anymore. They just end up typing and looking at their texting and making videos constantly. Or if they are a particular kind of personality, they had to take drugs as well to pump up the feeling of being superlative with the Web 2.0 multiple bodies. So back to the...
Right,
so I'm going, go ahead.
No, I was just going to interject and say, I mean, heroin has made a real resurgence lately. And
all the drugs get recycled. You will never be able to get rid of the drug reality in this world since the 50s, because electric media require drugs to simulate to keep up with the rapidity and super drugged effect of any of the electric and digital media. They're so drug-like collectively on mortar that naturally the little chemical body feels it's not keeping up. And that's why medicine went over into drug distribution. Why would medicine be so stupid to do that? Because they were inside a larger dynamic where everybody had to be in some kind of chemical program situation, program your body somehow. And, you know, the youth cultures, countercultures did grass, hash, LSD, junk, and all that. But the medicine staff did the same thing. They kicked all of the insane people out of the hospitals and then put everybody on drugs, which has, you know, been the bane of nonsense for Carolyn for 30 years. And Carolyn's finally come up with a way to bypass that. But why did it? The medicine stopped being any kind of recognizable doctor and just became a drug dispenser because everybody has to have their chemical body programmed across the society because you're super programmed and all your media super programmed by the five bodies. It's way beyond the apocalyptic image in the Bible. You know, we're talking about apocalypse quadrupled here compared to the way people, what they knew.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me go to the next place where I would like to try to... The other thing that I thought was interesting
was... Hey, I
didn't
get an idea, Katie.
What?
That's why the book of Revelation is just about angels. Humans were so obsolete when we got into this period of Armageddon and potential apocalypse and all that supposedly is happening and many destructive levels of social mortar.
Right now.
Last 30 years, say. The human body had no more say in it. The popular image now is you got drones fighting it. But that's why the book of Revelation doesn't have humans fighting it. It's angels having to fight. The angels are doing all the actual. They're the ones equipped to deal with this super angelic environment, McLuhan called it. You know how it's super angelic? Angels can be wherever they want to be. But when they're wherever they are, that's where they are. But when you're on this phone here, this digital telephone, we are potentially in the home of 6 billion people. I am angel. I'm everywhere at the same time, not just here, there, and everywhere, one after time sequentially like the angel. So I'm a super angel. So we've even outdid the traditional image of angels.
And we These are our wings.
More than that, because wings means flying. We're not flying. We're all resonating in the same membrane right now. We're all in one little invisible spot, maybe millions of angels on the head of a light bulb. We're not in a, on the head of a pin. We're inside a light bulb.
I don't really get that, but I'll let that.
Well, you know
in.
How they say in the medieval they count the number of angels on the head of a pin.
Dance on the head of a pin. Yeah, sure.
And now that's a visual thing, and you have this little sewing needle or something. But the electronic membrane, the digital world that the telegraph brought in, the biological event actually was a global membrane that on the surface, when you develop movies, radio, TV, satellites, computers, and then the digital media. They shrunk, they cluttered the little head of the pin or the little membrane, this electric point. I shouldn't have said pin, that's visual. The membrane, resonating membrane, which is a very responsive icon that people use all the time now. This
is that called the noosphere?
Yes, the noosphere, where it has endless news, N-E-W-S, and basically hangs everybody's chemical body, hangs them up. Noosphere.
I thought it was N-O-U-S. I'm talking about the Pierre de Chardin.
I know, me too.
You're doing with the pun.
I was being creative. Yeah.
You were being creative. That was good.
You know, it's N-O-O-S-E, Noosphere, not N-O-U-S. N-O-U-S is a derivative. But that means us, I think, new. But anyways, N-O-O-S is N-E-W-S, and the noose, the hangman's noose. So,
oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
So this membrane, this resonating, like our angelic diagram that we get with chapter 23, this resonating thing has been cluttered more and more with visual, kinetic, and all the senses. Movies are an extension of the eye and the foot. That's why the wheel, was an extension of the foot or feet in rotation, becomes externalized and squared in the movie, which is the foot in motion. You move without your chemical feet with the movie environment. That was what it was. The eye and the foot was the 20s and 30s. And then what happened with television? It's way different from movies. It's simultaneous. You don't go to one little place and look at it. Like, movies are almost like reading a book or driving a car. But when you get watch TV, it's like flying around in a jet plane. So television is an extension of the eye and the tactility, the whole sensory complex. So, and then the digital is just the Android meme replaying themselves for themselves and not you. So why do we get onto that? The what was the noosphere, the noose, I'm trying to explain how we don't dance on the head of a pin. We dance inside a membrane that's both inside us and outside of us, and we're inside everybody's digestive system, and they are inside our digestive system. So we are super angelic.
Oh, Bob,
okay,
I want to say something about the angelic thing is...
Let's just check this. See, Ginny has her own show, so she can actually demute herself when she wants to come in. So I guess she's kicked her neighbors out of her home, and she's ready to talk, which is we're welcome because she's interested in this stuff. So let's just hear what Ginny has to say.
Well, I was thinking, Bob, about this whole thing about the angels, and I really feel that you're... Yes,
well, Ginny, when you say... I'm going to interrupt you here. This whole thing, that phrase, nobody ever said this whole thing 100 years ago. But because television extends the central nervous system and was the ending of all the extensions of our faculty, that whole history that Katie just read in Understanding Media... The electric environment is totalistic, and so everybody's trying to be holistic, totalistic, so it becomes part of our language to say the whole thing. Just wanted to show you how your language is affected by electric media as a subconscious impact.
This is my complete point right here. I believe that angels...
Yeah, complete. There you are. You think we have completed with the satellite extending the planet, so watch your language as you make an opinion.
Okay, here's my opinion. My opinion is that the angels are effective because they are not subject, nor do they employ the use of any alphabetic influence whatsoever, and therefore they could not possibly be media. And we are not angels. No, absolutely not. I think that angels go beyond any use of alphabet at all.
Remember what Ian said? The angels are neither physical nor non-physical. That's where I started thinking they were machinic. I use the phrase machinic. They're like machines. There's something we created to service us. They're maybe the original service mechanism. And so you're right to say they're not human and they're not non-physical. They are in this in-between. That's why I think they are media. But they're not any one media. They're the machinic, which applies to every technology ever made, including speech. You see what
I'm
saying?
Yes, I do see what you're saying. They are media in terms of extensions, because they're definitely an extension of us. But they have to be an extension. I mean, they're the original extension before there was language.
Yeah, I would agree that they are not media. They're not social mortar. But our image, but mortar creates cultural images of what they are. But they're not that. We don't even know if the machines, as they evolve, change. Well, we're going to have incredible machines where the ever-range predictor will be two-thirds metal, but it won't be rods of steel. It'll be some very abstract or something we develop. Our technologies that we're going to make through INDEM are going to be so small that scientists will think it's antimatter, but it isn't. But antimatter could be what... involves this media level that the angels are part of. So I agree. I say there are images of them are machinic, but they aren't. But then our technologies may become aren't. You know what I mean? Look at the RNA drops. That's art. We don't know what it is. It comes from another world, right? But it's a technology.
Yes, I agree. I agree with all those statements.
Okay, so well, what are the point? Drops? If we just a minute, Katie. So,
sure.
Katie, now that we agree with what you're trying to say, what are you trying to say? What is your point about this? Are you just defining angels?
The point that I made. You said we're all angels, and I had to cut in and say no.
No, super angels, machinically. Yes, so you're saying we're not angels. That's true.
Yes. That's okay. So, and then I went on to elaborate to say that my considerations about angels have put me in a place of defining them or framing them in such a way that they are not subject to, nor do they employ the use of language in the alphabetic sense of language.
Right.
And the organization of thoughts and words.
Okay. What's the language?
You got to stop when I speak
because we'll get it all said. But let me just respond. You start off saying they're not language. Well, before speech, what was the medium? It was ESP, or what McLuhan called nonverbal mental gesture, whatever is the most subtle form of communication. Angels, were they involved with that? Yeah, they probably had ESP, or that's how we perceived them. So that was the original thing, and they are not ESP, right? Even though that was the first technology.
That's right. We created them to be in service to us, and we would have to have created them in a, just like Ion said, we're changing the way that words create. We had to have created angels in the way that we were not using language.
Yeah, we created, well, the angels probably were here before any kind of communication between humans, because the ascended human doesn't communicate. Doesn't have to really connect to anybody else. But with the beginning of the fall into descending slightly, still being quite ascended, that's when electricity and interaction happens. So at that highest level of the first levels of the fall, did the angels come then? Maybe, you know, to deal with, to help you get back to the ascended state. So I'd say imagine the most advanced, subtle form of communication among ascended people. At the first level of the first degree of fallenness, the angels probably were there at that point, or were created to be maybe the conflict. Because once you know, once the fall, slightly fallen, ascended people started interacting, they'd have contrast. And then they'd do something, and maybe they had to make angels be an intermediary. And they weren't even dying yet. You know, cavemen did not really die. If they did, they did not notice it. So I'm trying to put your, I'm agreeing with what you're trying to find about the angels. Let's put it back the very beginning there, of the fake beginning, you know.
Yes, the beginning of the fake beginning. Yes, that's right. And then that's why I was just going on to say that they're uniquely qualified to do what you said, which is to manage Armageddon, basically, because they're not limited by language like we are.
Right. It's occurring to me that if we're refining ourselves so subtly and technologically that we're evoking, the angels will become visible. They are like we're retrieving the original first level of fallen state. So as we get more advanced and have new degrees of Armageddon, the angels will become more visibly part of it, because that was the original. We will retrieve the original ground that the angels were visible on. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Right. They're like the last technology, and they're almost the desire for extension, for communication. That's why they may be neither physical or non-physical, because those two terms involve communication. But the ascended person's not even here, so to speak. Doesn't necessarily exist. He is experiencing, but there's no recognizable form. And they could adopt any form they want. So the angels could be the first attempt to communicate between ascended gods.
Very good. I like that.
And that's never been said before, that we have a whole new interpretation theologically of what we're confronted with today.
Yeah, that's very good.
Now, I want to tell you, Ginny, I have a very new insight. I have a new definition of what ion is. Ion is an isotope, but I would say to not limit it to that phenomenon in physics and chemistry. Ion is isotopic. What does the isotope do? It goes through half-life. It registers mutations between the elements. In recent, whatever I processed this week, I can't remember right now, it was a pretty exclusive session I came across. And the isotope has a whole new meaning for us. So I don't know if I can say much more, but angels could be isotopic. Isotopic.
Oh, that's neat. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Okay,
that's
back
very cool.
to...
Back to
what, Carol? And we can be... We're isotopes, yes. The way to look at it is when we shift to another world... We've just shifted our isotopic frequency.
Oh, nice.
Right. So that when you, Ian says that you go to another world through the cell, well, just
yes.
think of the role of the isotope in the cell, and the isotope is a registration of a change in the substance to another thing. Well, that's going to another world. So that should blow your mind, Katie. That's
yeah.
a chemical, well, a physics term to relate to parallel traveling. The role
well,
of the
it also
isotope.
Relates to media changing each other. I mean, it would
yes.
register that.
We live, you know, if you look at my tiny note chart and someone's requested me to talk about that, you know, many hours from now, yeah, I can do that, do a little introduction, but I have subatomic particles on the chart because I considered every shift on that chart from LaRouche, which is radio, to McLuhan is TV, Thompson is computer, and Coker is satellite, and then me, I'm anthropomorphic physical. The shifting among them were subatomic shifts, isotopic shifts, and that's why I have them, subatomic particles in each quadrant. The subtlety of shifts are happening even faster and faster with the ionic products. So, yes, the physics terms can hardly keep up with the shifting we're doing now with the non-physical effects of RNA drops and et cetera. The angstrom, you know, the invisible, the tiny, tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So, Katie, back to you. What did you, we dropped off to Jeannie, so back to your point, your next point.
Well, I have one question, and then I have another media that I want to talk about. But the question that I was going to ask when Jeannie was on the phone was, and she's probably still there, so what are the ionic products as technology an extension of, or would that not pertain to them because they're not from this world?
Now, this is really neat.
So we didn't create them.
Yeah, what I'm going to say, I've said many times, but it just shows you people cannot hear it. They cannot register it. Now, you're ready to hear it now because you asked the right question. McLuhan cracked the code and announced it in 53, the same year the genetic code was announced by Crick and Watson. Well, he cracked the general media environments and how they affect culture and other media environments. And that was all based on the technology that extended human faculties. And that ends with the satellite, extends the planet. Then phase two... is not any more extensions of our body or of the satellite. It's the extension of the extensions themselves. So the machines that have been extended from our senses, they start extending themselves in a digital matrix, and that's the second phase, and that's I'll call it Android Meme. Well, a couple of years ago, I figured out, well, phase three is the extension of non-physical and all that that word means. Ionic products are from the non-physical. That's why they're more powerful and go beyond the physical phase that McLuhan cracked the code of, the Android meme phase, which Coker and I cracked the code of. Now we have the ionic, which is a new environment, and we're still learning what the code is and might not have to know anything about it. So we have come to the third phase. That's what ionic products are, extensions of the non-physical. Whereas you can look at phase one, the machines, the extensions of our faculties, and phase two, the machines extend themselves. That's physical. But now we've gone into non-physical, which is a subtler kind of physicality. Right?
I get it. Yeah.
See, three phases. Makes total sense.
Yeah.
And this is what William Irwin Thompson, Croker, and LaRouche, and Eric McLuhan, they don't know. They're not listening. They're not paying attention to what Bob has broken through with the third phase, and we got products that prove it. I mean, we're going to hear them. But you see the incredible results Carol's getting in her this week in magnesium effects, REMAG effects. You know, we can cite anything. Lewis Mumford didn't have a fucking chemistry thing that he distributed that altered people regardless of whether they understood his concepts or not. Neither did McLuhan. Neither did Thompson, Croker, LaRouche, or anybody else. Terrence McKenna, well, maybe he did a little drug dealing side, but that didn't lead anywhere. So we are really the most amazing people on the planet right now. And you can
see
who's that? Who's this we? You know, I don't even have to include Bob M, but it might include some others, too.
So we should be pompous.
That's right. We can. We can buy it. Anytime you bump into somebody that won't take your RNA drops, you say, you're just a fucking idiot, and walk on. And you don't even have to explain yourself.
Right.
Just make sure they don't have a gun or something.
And I think that's, that what you just said about not even having to explain anything, that in not to talk about myself, I won't talk about myself very long, but in my blown mind state, that's more how I feel. I feel like I'm kind of walking around now, and there's almost like a membrane between me and the rest of the world. Like, I'm here, and I'm watching what's going on, but,
here, look at it this way. You create with new words. When you read McLuhan or anybody that I recommend, you think those new thoughts. You think a new perspective. That immediately separates you from the hoi polloi, just because you're saying to yourself, maybe saying out loud, new words, new ideas, that makes you, that mutates you. That's why you would feel different.
Yeah, I feel mutated.
Yeah.
In a good way. In a good way.
Yeah.
Okay,
and,
go ahead.
No, that's it.
Okay, so the other media that I wanted to talk about is numbers. I found the chapter about numbers, how primitive people see up to number six, and then they see a heap. They don't go past that. And
that
how
three-letter
numbers,
man did not have a strong sense of the individual. In the cultural sense, they still were gods, whatever, among themselves, you know, whatever they had developed. But usually the masses, the tribal people, they did not have the literate sense of defined visual space where they could read a book and have their own idea. They didn't have any of that. They just all danced and tribally hypnotized, like the old Japanese movies. You know, Hollywood presented Japanese in the 30s as real robotic. Well, tribal people were robotic. And so it didn't matter in particular whether they had 400 people or 500. They just needed about 400 to go beat up the other tribe. So they get a clump together and say, yeah, we got about 400 here. They didn't care if anybody got killed or got dropped off. There was no particularity. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's pre-literate numbering.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was even some stuff in that chapter, too, about trying to count Roman soldiers and being unable to do it because there was no zero, and so the invention of the zero.
Isn't it interesting? The history of culture, like the Euclidean geometry. Nobody other than the Greeks developed this kind of geometry because they did not. Nobody else got abstracted in their minds by the phonetic alphabet, which had letters not looking like ideograms or pictures. So they got abstracted in the space, and they start making patterns in the space, and that's your normal Euclidean geometry. So they were unique in that, and that's first level of mathematics. That then they couldn't get to the algebra of say Descartes and Newton and Leibniz and those guys until they went through the Arabic invention of the zero. And the Arabs are getting literate with their Mohammedan religion and the mastery of culture, but they're also very different because they don't live in any industrial environment. They're living in the deserts and different quality. So they actually were more aware of the gap. So they started to visualize the gap. The Western man didn't have the sense of the gap. He was just making literate connections. So they come up with zero. And then zero was a revolution in math for, 500 years. Then Descartes started to abstract to the, they called the hedonistic calculus. And then you get into the 19th century with Riemann, and they start making non-Euclidean geometries, non-visual. Now we'd gone into the electric tactility with the telegraph and radio, and math and its images had to change. And that's how you study knowledge today. You watch how the different cultural systems or memes or disciplines change when you bring in a new medium. That's how you engage in knowing, the game of knowing in social mortar. You watch the figure of math and how it changes as the ground or technology changes. That's a good way to occupy the mind. That's a more advanced way to understand where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so numbers started with counting, so that's an extension of the hand and of
the ground. Which is tactile. Yes, numbers are the first abstraction, moving towards visual space. They're not quite visual space yet until you get to geometry and the Greek culture. But before that, and they had the abacus or apagus, and then you'll use your fingers. Mm-hmm. But numbers were the beginning of tactile space going towards visuality. And the first expression of that were the pyramids. They made huge sculptural monuments because people, I don't know, it's like when they start to engage with visual space, they already had such huge power of invisible space. They lived in the swamp of the invisible that if you start to visualize, you had to make a big structure to show it. So huge monuments and huge pyramids were the beginning of visualization of a tactile society.